Welcome back. With this lecture, we begin a more detailed examination of specific hominid forms. Now, hominids have been known to science for quite a long time. Some were discovered in the 19th century, and of course, since then, we have been steadily accumulating examples of hominids. We'll hear in later lectures about some of the finds in the late 1800s and the earlier 1900s. But clearly the year 1974 was a turning point for paleoanthropology, and it is on this that I want to focus at the start of this lecture. In this year, the anthropologist Don Johansson found the fossil form we know as Lucy. The story of this find actually begins the year before, 1973. As a graduate student, Don Johansson went to a remote area of Ethiopia called Hadar. You must picture a really dry, desolate, badlands type of place in which a team of people was searching for early hominid fossils. In 1973, Johansson had great luck, especially as a graduate student, and uncovered what turned out to be a bipedal knee. So this was a knee joint that he found, and it was dated to 3 million years ago, and it was totally a surprise that it was, in fact, both bipedal and that old. He tells a great story of finishing the field season, packing up the bones, flying them from Ethiopia back to the United States, bringing them to a friend of his who was an expert anatomist, and literally laying the bones out on this person's home carpet and saying, hey, are these really bipedal as I think they are? And the answer was yes, and the date was confirmed. Clearly, without surprise, Johansson got funding for the next year and went back, and it is in this second year, 1974, that he uncovered the 40% complete skeleton of Lucy. Now, the date for Lucy is actually 3.2 million years, just a little bit different than the bipedal knee, but the same general area. Lucy was then unusually old, unusually complete, and quite surprising in a combination of two anatomical factors. First of all, she was bipedal. Secondly, she had an ape-sized brain. There was no brain expansion from the size of what we find in chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans. Now, this combination of factors really rocked paleoanthropology. Scientists had perfectly expected to find large brains evolving before upright walking in the human line. And remember, we need to think back now, 1974. But Lucy, as we have just heard, had an ape-sized brain and was clearly walking around upright. We could tell that from many specific features of her skeleton that we'll talk about in just a minute. Let me give you a general description of Lucy. We're calling her Lucy because that's what Johansson named her after a Beatles song playing at camp. He determined that she was, in fact, female based on her pelvic structure. It's a good way to tell sexes apart in fossil forms. She apparently died at about the age of 20. It is possible to estimate this from molar eruption, from the sequence of back teeth that was present in the fossil form. She was really quite small, probably 4 feet or under, possibly around 65 pounds. She had a rather primitive skull on top of this bipedal skeleton. Now, by primitive, I mean that it didn't look really modern. It was, for one thing, what we call prognathic. Prognathic is a technical term that means that the lower jaw jutted out in front of the brain case. It is not the way our skull is oriented, where our lower jaw is tucked in underneath our brain, but rather there's a kind of diagonal slope, if you will, to the face of Lucy. She also had teeth that were somewhat more primitive than we might have thought. She had canines, eye teeth, that were the longest of any hominid found up to that point. They're shorter than great apes, but longer than any hominid known as of 1974. There are other things, too, that contribute to this assessment of having a relatively primitive skull. In fact, Johansson described Lucy and many of her traits as intermediate between great ape anatomy and modern human anatomy. So it's possible in a laboratory to lay out a great ape's, modern living great ape's cadaver and a human body, do the anatomical comparison, then bring in this 40% complete skeleton and make comparisons. And in some of the features that I've mentioned for you, you get an intermediate status. For example, the canine teeth is a good such example, intermediate between the two. It is also true, for example, that the shape of the tooth row, the way that the teeth are laid out in the jaw, is not the way we have it, not the way apes have it, but somewhere in the middle. The apes have a kind of square, boxy shape. We have more of a parabola, and Lucy is in the middle. Now, it's important not to misunderstand from this term intermediate. It is important not to conclude that this means Lucy was some kind of a missing link. And you're already well equipped to know why this would be an inaccurate conclusion. Humans and apes shared a common ancestor. Humans and hominids did not evolve directly from the great apes, so there's no link in a linear chain to be missing in the first place. The term missing link continues to be used in the media quite frequently, and even in popular science literature, and it really shouldn't be, because it reinforces a stereotype that is mythical. Now, since the time that Lucy was found and named Australopithecus afarensis, other examples of this species have been found. I can tell you that we already had an example before of Australopithecus. Australo means southern, Pithecus is ape man. The afarensis part of the term refers to the area of Ethiopia. Afar is a general region in which Hadar, the specific site, was found. So there are now about 350 fossils of this form, representing probably around 100 individuals. So we have a robust accounting of individuals in this species. The time range for Australopithecus afarensis is between about 3.6 million years ago to about 3 million years ago. Let's discuss bipedalism of this form more specifically. Now, Johansson and his team are quite adamant. They have been from the start. They continue to be to this day. The anatomy of this species, yes, was in some ways ape-like or intermediate, but they insist that its bipedalism was modern in form. In other words, Johansson says that Lucy was an advanced obligate biped. She had to walk bipedally. Her skeleton was designed so much towards bipedalism that she had no other choice. Well, not everybody agrees with this. Let's review the factors that Johansson uses to support his argument. He looks quite with a lot of emphasis at the pelvis of Lucy. If you review what it takes to be a biped, let's take our own bodies, modern human bodies, as an example. We see that the pelvis is key. The pelvis is relatively short and broad compared to what you would find in an ape. It is a stable part of the body for weight bearing. The lower part of a biped is very important, the lower half of the body, for weight bearing, stability. Every time we take a step, we have to reestablish our stability. Bipeds have a straight knee, a knee that can lock. We have a pelvis that puts the weight through our lower body, through that knee, down to our feet. A stable foot where the five toes are in line with each other. And what Johansson says is that this is essentially what Lucy already had by 3 million years ago. Quite different, in other words, from a great ape's powerful upper body. The focus is on the lower body. Opponents of this idea do not in any way doubt that Lucy was bipedal. It's important to realize that there is consensus on the point of bipedalism for hominids generally. The question, though, is could she really have been so modern in the way that she walked? Could she have been so obligatorily bipedal? Skeptics say that Johansson looks too much at the pelvis. He focuses really on the pelvis and the knee to the exclusion of other areas in their view. What about looking at the fact that Lucy has long arms? And at the end of these arms, curved fingers, fingers that end in a kind of hook-like structure that is quite reminiscent of the great apes. Remember that the brachiation complex is the upper body complex, and the arms are long in that case. Furthermore, Lucy has relatively long toes and long feet. And I should add that I'm using Lucy as a shorthand. I really mean the individuals represented by the Australopithecus afarensis specimen array, but Lucy is easier to say, and I think that you know what I mean. So these skeptics say it is unlikely that Lucy moved as we do, that she would have had possibly even a shuffling type of gait, but they say this is something that we should expect, both from evolutionary theory and even from an understanding of paleoecology, ancient ecology. And here's why. The area of Hadar back around 3 million years ago was, of course, not what it looks like today, not totally arid, looking like a wasteland, but rather quite lush and green with lakes. Multiple animal species were found with their bones dating back to 3 million years ago, elephant, giraffe, pigs, birds, all living in the same area in an ecosystem, and there were lots of trees around. The scientists who oppose Johansson's interpretation say that it makes perfect sense that bipedalism, in terms of its form, would have evolved gradually, and that Lucy should have been adapted to being able to make use of the trees. The short feet and toes, the long arms and curved digits would be adaptations to allow her to move fluidly between walking on the ground and making use of the trees. In fact, this second view of a fluid adaptation for Australopithecus afarensis is more of a consensus. More biological anthropologists embrace that view of Lucy than the one where she was a modern type of biped. Beyond bipedalism, we know quite little about the behavior of Australopithecus afarensis. This species is definitely a good candidate for modeling, whether referential, phylogenetic, or conceptual modeling using great apes. We can wonder about the tool-using and tool-making capabilities of Australopithecus afarensis. We have no evidence of fossilized tools with this species. Of course, organic tools, tools that are made out of branches or grass, would not fossilize. And we know that chimpanzees rely on such organic tools, for example, in termite fishing and other things, quite heavily. Of course, we know that Lucy had an ape-sized brain. It seems likely, although only speculative, that Australopithecus afarensis was capable of using tools in a way probably not too different from the chimpanzee, but we can only speculate and rely on modeling. When it comes to things like social groups and social organization, how did male and female Australopithecus afarensis live? Did they live in one male units, multi-male, multi-female? No clue. And we just don't have a way to really answer that question. Lucy continues to be an extremely important touchstone for biological anthropology because she changed our views so much and because we've learned so much from her. However, it's an inescapable conclusion that she has been dethroned as the oldest hominid on record. As I warned you last lecture, this was coming. We know that the time period of human evolution has been pushed back quite a lot. So certainly at 3 million years ago, Lucy is an important hominid, but she cannot be considered the basal hominid of the human family tree. At the present time, the oldest hominid appears to be the one that was announced in the summer of 2002 from the country of Chad, Sahelanthropus chadensis. Six specimens were found in Chad, including a nearly complete skull and good bones from the lower jaw. There were fragments of the lower jaw. So this is mostly skull material that we have above the neck. And clearly what we would like is what's called postcranial skeleton, below the neck. We would dearly like to know about this new find if it was bipedal. And we cannot say at this point for sure. We can look at the skull and say that nothing about it precludes bipedalism. Nothing about it definitively suggests bipedalism. So this is a question mark that we still have. Well, the person who led a team to find this creature deserves a lot of credit. His name is Michael Brunet, and he comes from France. He insisted that searching in the desert of Chad would one day be a successful effort, and he was right. Many people didn't think he should be looking in this area for human ancestors. So a close analysis of the skull and lower jaw fragments has just been published. It is interesting to note that the face looks more modern than we might have thought based on the time period. And it is only going to be with real full community analysis of these bones, if you will, that the significance emerges. What I mean by this is now scholars need time to review the bones and the data to suggest what it might mean that the face looks more modern than we thought, and to see if subsequent expeditions will be able to locate postcranial bones to find out for sure if this creature was a biped. So it's still very early on in understanding Sahelanthropus, and we can't draw a lot of really firm conclusions yet. Before 2002, we thought we had identified the earliest hominid in the year 2000. Now, I know a lot of people who order their textbooks to teach in the fall over the summer, and there's a whole bunch of biological anthropologists around the country waiting for new editions of textbooks to come out for the fall, because these new textbooks will include information about the find that was made in the year 2000. So finally they were thinking we're going to have an up-to-date textbook, and then the 2002 find was announced. And of course it's too late to put that in the textbook, so we have to wait for yet another version. Well, what was discovered in the year 2000? It's a form that was nicknamed Millennium Man, because it was the year 2000. The Latin binomial name is Aurorin tuginensis. And here we have a form that is 5.8 million years ago and definitely bipedal according to its discoverers. In fact, the paleoanthropologists who are giving this information to us claim that the lower bones of the legs show even more pronounced and clear bipedality than do Lucy's. This is really revolutionary if true. In fact, the analysis of the bones for Aurorin tuginensis have proceeded relatively slowly. We don't have even yet a great deal of highly technical analysis. We will assume that the origins of bipedalism include Aurorin tuginensis at 5.8 million years ago. We're assuming it's likely that Sahelanthropus will turn out to be bipedal. But again, some of this is really too new to have quite settled down throughout the layers of our biological, anthropological understanding. Now, we know that other species, too, existed before 3 million years ago. I just have gone through for you the two so-called hot spots where people are really paying attention, Aurorin and Sahelanthropus. But what else do we have at this early time period? Well, there's a lot of names that I could trot out for you, multiple examples. What I have decided to do is not give you an exhaustive, comprehensive list of early hominids, but to give you some examples, with the idea behind them being for you to know that different hominid species coexisted even quite early in human evolution. This is a quite important point. We will use the work of one of the Leakeys as an example. We have talked about the Leakey family as so critical in paleoanthropology, the Lewis and Mary sort of elder generation of the Leakeys, Richard and Meave, the next generation of Leakeys. I'm going to focus for you on Meave Leakey for just a minute. She found fairly recently a fossil find in Kenya dated to 4.2 million years ago, so well over, well, a million years before Lucy. She called it Australopithecus anamensis. This reflects the fact that it is like enough to Lucy to be included in the same genus, Australopithecus, but unlike Lucy enough to have a different species designation. So there are anatomical details that differ from Lucy and have pushed back the Australopithecine time period for us. I heard her speak at National Geographic in Washington, D.C. some years ago, I'd say about 3 years ago, and she talked about finding 21 different fossils that she later named Annamensis, and the fact that they are clearly bipedal. And at that time, this was very old, 4.2 million years ago. You know, you can get usurped really quickly in paleoanthropology, but a few years ago, that was very big news, and still is, to be fair. For any of you who might live or visit the Washington, D.C. area, I certainly recommend keeping up with the speaker series at the National Geographic, because it is possible to go there and hear and meet in person some of these leading paleoanthropologists. Now, a second find that Maeve Leakey has made more recently is probably even more significant. This is a find from 3.5 million years ago, and that is important because it means it overlapped with Australopithecus afarensis. 3.5 million years ago is right in that time period of Lucy and her kind. So it means, again, behavioral diversity early on. This find has been termed Kenyanthropus platyops. And that platyops term means flat face. And here is a key feature that distinguishes this form from Lucy. Remember that I told you Lucy's face is prognathic, that the jaw juts out sort of away from the brain case. This is not so much the case for Kenyanthropus at 3.5 million years ago. The face is simply more flat, less snout-like, if you will. There's a nearly complete skull associated with this find, and it leads us to think about interesting issues. The two forms were in the same basic area, East Africa, and we expect that they probably had different diets because of their different skulls. They probably did not directly compete, but again, these are questions that are just being entertained now in the last few years. So Maeve Leakey has done really critical work in illuminating the early time period and showing us that it is not a linear ladder-like succession of forms, but rather lots of forms existing at once. Now, this recent flowering of hominid species discoveries has presented real challenges for scientists as well as for students of biological anthropology. And this is something we need to acknowledge up front. It is true that when I teach this course at William & Mary, quite often my students become a little bit discouraged by all the names and the dates and the sites. But it is true also that things are changing so rapidly that the scientists themselves find it somewhat difficult to keep up. We need to know not only the anatomical descriptions of these finds and where they're found, but how they relate one to the other. How does a discovery change, if it does at all, the drawings that we make of the human family tree? And this is quite challenging. And of course, paleoanthropologists don't always agree with each other. So we have, first of all, a new array of forms that are still being worked out, and secondly, good scientific disagreement within the field. And I refer to it as good because it's very healthy. We need to have debates about what certain things mean, the implications of finding very old bipedal ancestors, the implications of finding two different forms at around 3.5 million years ago, the implications of having a flat-faced form versus a more prognathic form. All these things have to be worked out. What I would suggest is if these hominid names are beginning to blur a little bit, which I'm quite sympathetic with, is to focus on two in particular, to be able to feel comfortable with knowing something about two hominids. And the two hominids I would choose are, first of all, Sahelanthropus chidensis, the newest one that is dated to near 7 million years ago. Because it's so important, I mean, the combination of the date and the geographic origin is just really shocking. This form was found a full 1,500 miles to the west of where we had been looking. And what that does then is it tells us that we need to be looking in different places and thinking differently geographically as well as chronologically. So this is a form that you want to follow, as it were. And what I mean by that is to follow the interpretations of it and what people do with this information and how things play out over the next couple of years. The second hominid that I would choose for you to really become comfortable with is, unsurprisingly, Australopithecus afarensis. I referred to Lucy before as a type of touchstone in biological anthropology. And here we have, first of all, one of the top five most complete fossil skeletons known in the world. So we know we're on firm ground here. We're not making guesses from scattered bits of pieces. We know we have about 100 other individuals in her same species of Australopithecus afarensis. The details of bipedalism are clear. No debate about afarensis being bipedal. The mechanics of the way that the walking occurred is being modeled all of the time. The debate between a focus on the pelvis and the knee, showing obligate bipedalism, versus a more distributed analysis suggesting a fluid adaptation between terrestrial walking and climbing, is very important, because from Lucy, we will be able to learn a lot about how the static bones translate into dynamic walking. And that continues even 30 years after the finding of Lucy. So keep in mind the two species, but really the take-home lesson of this lecture is a conceptual one. Going back to the very first lecture, I had promised you that we were going to prioritize the concepts of this course and make them more significant than the sites and the dates. And the take-home concept here is early behavioral diversity. We've been focusing mostly on a 4-million-year-old time period that starts right after the divergence from the common ancestor of this human lineage, 7 million years ago, let's say, to 3 million years ago. So we've been focusing on two ends of the continuum there in talking about Sahelanthropus and Australopithecus afarensis. Well, the concept is that there's much more going on in terms of flowering of speciation at this time period than we ever would have expected. It is still too easy to fall into the trap of thinking about human evolution as a ladder, as one form succeeding another. And we've known rationally and intellectually for a long time that this wasn't true. But really, only in the last 5 to 10 years do we have the fossil evidence to show that there is this wide bush-like form, if you will, at the base of the human family tree. There's competition, and creatures that live and die out. Our challenge is to figure out which one of these, or possibly multiple ones of these, were real direct human ancestors on the direct human lineage. We will find out later that some hominids lived but were essentially side branches. They lived and were successful for some period of time, but then went extinct. And we're trying to sort all that out now to make the behavioral bushy diversity fit into what had to have been a pattern of succession, some species leading to some other species. That remains to be done. Coexisting species play a very large role in the story of human evolution after this time period as well. We have worked with the 4 million years that I've described for you at the early stage. We want to continue in succeeding lectures to get into the time period after 3 million years ago, and we will find very much a similar concept, that we will get different lineages coexisting. And I'll be describing for you how they differentiated one from the other. The exciting thing about the hominid evolution that is yet to come, that we will be describing, is that we can start getting into a little bit more of behavior and even culture. At around 2.5 million years ago, which is not very far away from where we are now, we start getting evidence for stone tools. We start being able to talk in a sensible way about social behavior and culture and evolution. So we will pick up next time with talking about the very first types of hominids in our own genus. We will move into consideration of the genus Homo when we return in the next lecture.